Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everyone, the fall season is quickly approaching and it's time to start taking a look at your gear. So make sure you're not overlooking the gear. Sometimes matters the most, and that's what you're going to be using to process your wild fish or game after you bring it home. What we're doing in order to help prepare you for that is we're going to be giving away a meat grinder, and how you enter that contest is you scroll down on the show notes, click the link that says meat grinder giveaway, and then follow the directions and around about the middle of June, we'll announce the winner, and we will give away one of these awesome meat grinders. So, good luck, and hope to see you entering and sharing with your friends and family. Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and today I actually have two guests with me. Well, one's a special guest, and the other one is one of our field staff riders, who's going to introduce himself momentarily, and then we're going to get on and introduce our guest in. First off, I want to go over a quick couple admin things. So make sure you're checking out our Adventures for Food podcast. So for those that haven't heard or seen them yet, a quick, like, 5 to 10 minute story. So it's like adventures in the field of going out fishing, hunting, or whatever for food. So this past week we featured our first podcast listener episode, where somebody actually hopped on with Corey and they recorded their own adventures for food. So that was pretty cool. It was a great story. The guy went out deer hunting and ended up having to battle a bear in order to get his deer back to his truck. So go check that out and make sure that you're tuned into those. Those are releasing every other Sunday just on this same podcast channel. And then Facebook community group, be sure to check that out. Actually, Shrek here was the one that queued that up. So we've done really well with it, and we'd love interacting with everybody kind of on a more daily basis, a little more informal than our Facebook page. So if you have any questions or things like that, it also gives us the opportunity to share what guests we're having on the podcast, and then you can pose any questions and things like that, and we'll make sure we get some listener stuff in there. And then as always, if you're digging what we're putting out, you can buy us a cup of coffee. So it's a quick little thing, little $3 donation to the Harvesting Nature crew. You can buy 1, 2, 3, 7 cups of coffee. It's about my daily intake, so that works. And as always, our buddies over at Allen Company, if you go over to buyallen.com, that's BYALLEN.com, and check out their cool merch and use the code HARVEST10. You get 10% off on your order. So, with that, I'm actually going to open it up. Chase is here with us. Chase Waller, the infamous field staff rider for Harvesting Nature. And he wanted to hop on tonight because he's a big fan of spearfishing. And our buddy Shrek is on with us, too, from Australia, right?
Yep. But it's awesome to make Chase's acquaintance. So I'm quite familiar with Tampa, but I really want to get over there.
Yeah, man. It's you got to come over. It's a great time out here on the Gulf.
What are you spearing over there most of the time? Sheep's head?
Yeah, you get sheep's head closer inshore. You go offshore, you get a lot of gags and gag groupers and mangrove snappers are our two biggest, I would say, numbers wise. But you run into cobia, you run into amberjacks, you run into every once in a while somebody brings up a cobra. A couple years ago, I shot a blackfin tuna.
Yeah, right.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Man, it seems like you guys have got like such a wicked coastline in terms of the availability of the spearfishing resource. Like, obviously, some of the management strategies are working, but like, there's a really vibrant community there. Some really different sort of cultural factors in the Florida spearfishing community than the rest of the world, and sometimes there's a little bit of conflict. Have you experienced any of that?
Yeah, it's a little bit. You see it. You see it. Gulf Coast versus Atlantic Coast, Central Florida versus South Florida. I don't know what the North Florida guys are doing up there, but that's what I see.
Mm. Yeah, like the guys up in the Panhandle and stuff. They kind of have their own unique thing, and then us boys down here in the Florida Keys, unique too. I mean, it's interesting the cultures.
Mm. Yeah. For such a small state, like everything has its own like little microculture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in Brisbane, which is like the east coast of Australia, and we've got our own sort of distinctive culture as well, and it's different from some of the other states in Australia. But I originally came from New Zealand as well, and I think like that's partly why I sort of sometimes see the distinctions and the differences, and it's interesting sort of. I don't know. Social media's brought us all together, and sometimes for the better, and sometimes for the worse. But yeah. It's interesting to watch, to be part of.
So I got to do your quick introduction too. We write these fanciful introductions. So well, we've already covered the fact that you're living in Brisbane in Australia. So so everybody knows Shrek here, Spiro, podcast host and writer. So he hosts the Noob Spiro podcast and co-authored 99 Tips to Get Better at Spearfishing. Awesome blog he has too, and a website. Lots of cool things going over there at thenoobspiro.com.
Yeah, thanks, so, Justin.
Welcome
cool
to the show.
Yeah, it's cool to like be like. It was nice of you to invite me on your show. Like, I had a really good chat with you, and I know my listeners loved it. Like, I think I left the episode with you like super hungry because you unleashed like three like wicked recipes off your blog. So. It's cool to come in and chat with you and join your guys, but I hope I can offer some value.
Yeah, I think so. Definitely want to talk about some food stuff. I've got that kind of in the lineup, and then want to hit on the Noob Spiro podcast and talk about some spearfishing stuff too. I always find it kind of like a personal mission, you know. As a lot of people know, I'm down in the Florida Keys, and spearfishing kind of has popped in and out of my life as I've lived down here. And I think it's a should be fully recognized like part of both the angling community and the hunting community, because it involves both.
Mm.
And so I always think it's very, very important that we're recognizing that at Harvest in Nature sort of as a whole, because I mean, if you're spearing, you're generally out for food. Like, it's not like you're catch and release. So
yeah, it's very similar to hunting, I reckon. Like, there's that thrill of the chase, and there's the excitement, there's planning a stalk, you know, obviously finding the right conditions and locations in terms of like where the animals are going to be, and then you know, up choosing the right technique in order to take down some prey. But a lot of the time, I think fish are much dumber than animals on land. But, there's a lot of parallels, and I don't see it as dissimilar to hunting at all.
Yeah. It's funny because a lot of the spears I've talked to are like, some of them call it hunting. They're like, yeah, you know, we're going out. We're going to go hit the water and go do some hunting. And I'm like, all right, that's cool. Like, I recognize that. So then also, as I mentioned, we've got Chase here, and I'm going to let him go ahead and introduce himself.
Hey, like you said, Chase. I'm a field staff writer for Harvest in Nature, based out of Tampa, Florida. Been hunting and fishing my entire life, and I got into spearfishing. I was stationed in Hawaii for a few years, and then I kind of got away from it when I got back to Florida. I started back into more serious diving. I don't dive as much as I did in Hawaii, but I would say my spearfishing is much more productive in terms of just number of species and size of fish. But, you know, I love spearfishing because it is that hunting aspect. that I love, and fishing and I have kind of a toxic relationship. fish, but I love catching fish and don't enjoy getting my hooks untangled from stuff and losing stuff and getting sunburned while I'm not catching fish.
Yeah, just getting so fat.
That's the reason I enjoy spear fishing, because at least I'm also free diving.
Yeah,
you know, it's if I don't get anything, I would have had a good free diving trip.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And plus, it's like I always find it at the surface, you're always kind of in wondering what's down there, like what's below. Like I just picture a lot of times my hook just down there, and there'd be like nothing around, or there's a giant school of fish around, except for the little like little circle around where my fish hook is, and they're just like all swimming around it like nope, 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 nope. But when I'm down in the water with spear gun in hand, at least I get to see what's going on in that world, and you know, like Shrek said, it becomes like a little more like hunting, because you're seeing the playing field out there.
I think yeah, so many spearos and are terrible line or pole fishermen, and that's how we get into it. Yeah.
So for everyone, this is, as you know, Chase's first podcast on with us, so super stoked to have him on. We're actually going to have him on again, or, by the time you listen to this, he will already have been on, covering a little piece that he did on some cool issues going down here in Florida, so scroll back and check that out. But for those who didn't know, Chase and I just went turkey hunting. What, 2 weekends ago, Chase?
Yeah, 2 weekends ago.
Yeah, 2 weekends ago. Didn't see any turkeys.
At the time this is recorded.
Yeah. Didn't see any turkeys, so unsuccessful. But nonetheless, I'm headed back up for round two tomorrow morning, actually, bright and early.
Do you guys find like hunting and spearfishing is kind of similar, I reckon, in the fact that sometimes you go and you don't catch anything. But if you're with cool people, you have a good time anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And there's always like the campfires and, you know, the stories that seem to just grow over time.
Do you, Shrek, do you hunt as well, or have you hunted in the past?
A little bit. Like, as you get older, you just seem to have less time and less opportunity, even though you might have a little bit more money. Yeah, in Queensland here, we get red deer, and well, like near where I am in the Brisbane Valley. But yeah, I've hunted pigs a lot with dogs and knives, and I really enjoyed that. I like hunting deer with a rifle. I've only ever shot one deer with a rifle, so I would definitely wouldn't call myself a hunter, but I do enjoy it. I know how to butcher an animal because one of my first jobs was working in a beef sort of processing plant. So I got to see the industrial farming process, from the animal in the yards alive and well to coming out the other end in a box and everything in between. So it was a formative experience. But like, it gave me some skills in terms of how to break an animal down, and I really like that part of it. I love, whether it's fishing or hunting, just taking an animal from something that's alive all the way right through to the other end. And, you know, it gives you an appreciation for the animal, but obviously you're more aware of what's, you know, what's gone on to it. And I think it's a really cool, and I don't know, it's just something that most people don't understand.
Yeah, for me, it's almost like a natural feeling to it. To like there's a comfort in it because I know I'm involved in the process, and then there can be uncomfortable things about it, but for the most part, like, the process itself is like, oh, this seems like this seems legit. So
the first times, few times you gut an animal though, like they don't like, I started in New Zealand, like we would have invasive possums, and my parents were both ex-army officers in the New Zealand Army. So we grew up in the bush and with national parks all around, but we were allowed to shoot these possums. And I remember gutting and skinning, and a friend of mine taught me a little bit about tanning and stuff. And so I started really young for me, I think. And but, I mean, it's pretty gross the first time you go to gut an animal, pull all the guts out, and generally you do a clumsy job of it and pierce the gut sack in some way and it goes all over you, and you know how it goes.
I mean, even still as an adult, I still do that sometimes on accident.
Yeah.
So, grew up in New Zealand and introduced the outdoors there. That's pretty cool. What's the normal childhood growing up in the outdoors like there?
You got two main islands here. You got the North Island and the South Island. And I was born in the top of the South Island, but I grew up sort of more or less in the West Coast, sort of more or less to the bottom of the North Island. And it's cold and wet a lot of the time in winter. It rains a lot. It'll rain for a week. And particularly in the mountains where I sort of grew up, the place I grew up is called Puke Iti, which is Maori for like small hill. In Australia, where I am here in Brisbane, like it would be called a huge mountain for some reason because we just don't have a lot of them. But my dad was a gardener there, and so we were surrounded in bush. We had the Taranaki National Park with there was a big mountain sort of in the background and a line we had two lines of mountains around it. One's the Kaitakis, and always tramping, hunting, like possums, and just small game, like not really eating, hunting to eat a lot of the time, more just wiping out invasives and sometimes using the hides. But that was sort of how I grew up. I really enjoyed that. And then we moved to the city of 12,000 people when I was about 12 years old, and things changed a little bit, but still close to that sort of rural farming lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, I went to Meatworks as well, and moved to Australia in my early 20s and took up spearfishing probably 5 or 6 years later. It took me a while to get organised and save up for all the gear and stuff, but started scuba diving in New Zealand, and then when I moved here to Australia, was more interested in the freediving component. Like, I started freediving in New Zealand, and just getting rid of all the scuba gear was just, it was awesome. So, but I sort of had an ability for it. I grew up in swimming pools and near the water, so freediving for me, although, it's taxing and a struggle to learn how to relax and hold your breath, I really enjoyed it, and that sort of the self-mastery involved. I think even scuba diving with spearfishing, maybe there's some of that as well, but I've never really spearfished on scuba, so I don't have a huge appreciation for it, but yeah.
I think there's some folks that do I've seen them do scuba. Like down here, it's big for like lionfish, one of our big invasives. Mm. People will go scuba out there because you can harvest them much easier, and like you don't have to worry as far as going down on breath. And then after you shoot the fish, you got to trim you either got to put it in a what's called like a lionfish hotel, which is a little PVC tube, or clip the spines off and all that jazz. So people tend to, you can take your time when you're on a tank versus coming back up for air. So what's I gonna say? I guess starting to spearfish, what was the sort of the motivator behind it?
Oh, I never stopped wanting to spearfish. It was more just opportunity, time, and money, I think. Sort of struggled a lot through sort of blue-collar jobs and just not being very organized or having much of a plan or vision for my life, and struggled to sort of get organized in my 20s, probably near the back end. Some things happened in my life and changed, and I just started getting a lot more determined, and I saved up and bought the equipment. And then all the struggles started with, like, particularly in southeast Queensland here, it's really difficult to find places to shore dive. You really need a boat. And so, I struggled to find dive buddies in a community. Social media was really just starting to take off, but it wasn't very organized in terms of finding, groups and communities to join. And even when you do find them nowadays, like, it's still a big ask getting someone to take you out. Because taking a noob out is a real sacrifice, and it's a full day off. It's time and opportunity. And mm-hmm. if you're taking a noob out with you, oh jeepers, it's a hassle. They scare all the fish, and you just spend all day teaching, and it's really not the sort of spearfishing that you enjoy when you start to get better at it. But all those struggles came up, and I couldn't find a lot of dive buddies. It took me a while to get on a boat and just develop the skill set. Like I said, the barrier to entry in terms of the equipment was tough as well, and then learning how to use it. And so that's kind of also how I started the Noob Spirit podcast, because at the time, like, I was listening to Entrepreneur on Fire, which is a guy, he's an ex-military guy, he lived up in Maine when he started it. And he wanted to do a business podcast 7 days a week. I was working a blue-collar job. I started listening to this Entrepreneur on Fire podcast, and this guy just fired me up. And he's just like, just solve problems that you yourself experience. And I thought, well, I'm going to start a spearfishing podcast and just interview spearfishing legends from all over the place and learn how to get past some of these obstacles, like finding a buddy and learning all the equipment and the freediving side of things, the hunting, This is just like the deeper you down the rabbit hole you go, the more problems you realize there are and the more obstacles and, you know, and people are very much subject matter experts, you know. Like you talk to a person that's a dedicated spearfishing YouTuber, they've poured thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours into learning their craft, you know. Like it's silly just to learn all those same things yourself. Like sometimes you have to learn stuff yourself, but why not just talk to people that have already done it? So, yeah.
I think facilitating those conversations are good. It makes it shows, you know, I think we do that a lot. So I don't know if you have an equitable term in Australia, but it's like we have the like late onset hunter or late onset angler, like somebody who gets into hunting or fishing, you know, not like kind of Chase and I who grew up doing it, but somebody who's like, oh, I'm in college, I'm 20, 25, you know, 30, 40, 50, yeah, whatever. And they're like, I want to start hunting now.
Yep.
And they're like, you know, growing up, you're kind of taught like, here's the ways, here's how you do it. And, you know, I think a lot of older hunting culture in the US, like that was the way you started. Mm. And everybody who was involved in that kind of took it for granted. And then now there's a huge mass movement of adult onset hunters or later onset, I guess adult onset's the correct word. And so they're in this place like, oh, wow, like I'm trying to solve all these same problems, which is exactly, you know, people get into spearfishing. They're looking to you to be like, oh, yeah, I ran into that problem. Oh, great. They're having a whole podcast episode where they're talking about that. So it creates a comfort level for people, too. You know, we do that here with food and try to do it with our conversations and hunting and fishing and all that. So I always think it's neat when that falls into like, somebody's like, hey, I see that there are problems in the world and I'm going to share the ideas that I found on my path. So
sometimes it's like, you're right. Like you're that adult learner, you know, like a couple of years ago, I started jujitsu with the work I was in and like, well, walking in, you're in your late 30s learning something. It's very uncomfortable to not be in a zone of competence. It's like, there's an element of ego attached to it too. But I'm just hearing and listening to people who have battled the same problems as you, I don't know, it just gives you a little bit of comfort. It makes you feel like a little bit less of a loser. And and that's a good place to come from, you know, because I'm still very much a white belt in jiu-jitsu, by the way. But I think having those areas where you're still learning something keeps you honest too. And you just pull all the bullshit out of it. Like, very much like one of the reasons why I really loved having you on the podcast is I still consider myself a real noob with food, and I'm pretty lazy. Like after a full day spearfishing, my recipes, they better be under like 20 minutes, 30 minutes prep full time, because otherwise I'm probably not going to do it. Like if it's super elaborate, I just don't have the time and the energy to do it. So, but yeah.
I run into that where sometimes like I'm coming back and it's like, I got to clean fish, I got to do this, and then by the end of it, it's just like, I'm not even hungry anymore. Like, I'm so tired. I'm so mentally exhausted. Like, I'll eat tomorrow, and I'll put the you know, the fish in the freezer and it for another day, which leads me to a great segue. What kind of fish you got hiding out in the freezer there?
I've got a Moses perch actually in the freezer, which is, I think it's quite similar to the red snapper that you guys get in Florida. And, sometimes people call them a finger mark, but the flesh is really good. And I've got a coral trout, which is, generally it's uncommon to get them off Brisbane. It's generally further north, like proper sort of tropical water. If you're curious as to that species, Daniel Mann's actually got a YouTube video where he identifies all the coral trout species. But there's one in there, and there's a black spot tusk fish, which is it's a unique fish as far as I'm aware, really, to Australia. And it's got that same appeal, I think, as the hogfish has in Florida, but it's very much our own thing down here. And a big black spot tusk fish is they look rad, you know, like if you're laying on the bottom and one comes out of you, you know, from nowhere, they're just really distinctive and just a really cool fish to hunt. I don't think they're particularly clever though, so although you
same with hogfish.
Yeah, which is why I paralleled it, because it's like if you see a picture of one, they're just a wicked looking fish, and I think hogfish are kind of the same. And I don't know, it's they have this real character that's, you know, like you appreciate over time and exposure. And I really love them. So I got one of those in the freezer, and they eat really well as well.
I'm looking at a picture of one. It looks like a parrotfish got a real bad dental job.
Yeah. So they're a little bit like a parrotfish, but I think instead of like eating fungi and stuff off the coral reef, they more like smash things up on the bottom. Probably a little bit more like maybe a sheep's head, like in terms of their they get a lot of structure.
They got that like rassy looking teeth up
front. Yeah, and they taste
kind of like a hogfish's teeth.
Yeah, well, they taste way better than a parrot. Like the flesh is a lot more firm, and and it's actually a lot more transparent than a parrot as well. But yeah, they're really good eating. Whereas parrots, sometimes I think quality. I'm not really a big parrot fan. I think if you're really good with the ceviche, I think parrot maybe is the way to go. But I'm not. I'm it's just not a food I've really explored in depth. But I probably will start to do, because I think I've had a sort of a shift in mindset. Like, there's a Sydney seafood chef called Josh Nyland, and he wrote a book called The Whole Fish Cookbook. If you're a chef, dude, I think the book, or lady, sorry, I think the book is like wicked, because it's like super deep technical seafood stuff. But one thing the book didn't do is get me to start cooking these elaborate recipes. But what it did do is it convinced me to change my mindset around the way I think about fish. Like, I think we have these two recipes we use as Spiros, and that's all we do. And I think it's a little bit lazy, because, like he says, the analogy he uses in the book is you wouldn't go into a butcher shop and treat pork, beef steaks, beef mince, and, you know, all these different cuts the same. And yet with spearfishing, it's like, it's a fish. We'd treat them all the same. It's a fish. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a bit silly. Like, all fish, the flit has different flesh consistency based on their diet, temperature zone, all that sort of stuff. And so we should treat them differently. And so I'm starting to change a little bit. That's what I mean with the parrot, with the ceviche thing. It's like, I just haven't been cooking it right previously, so that's why I don't have an appreciation for it.
I think that has to do regionally as well, because when I was in Hawaii, we would get parrots, and that was like the prize fish for, you know, closer to on your reefs. And then on the mainland, I don't know anybody who shoots reef parrots.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can't shoot them. We can't shoot them down here in the Keys. They're protected.
Yeah, there's a case that a lot of marine scientists, and I would argue like extreme sort of green lobbying groups do, is they say parrots preserve the reef, and they eat the parasites off the reef and stuff. So when you shoot them, it creates an unhealthy balance in the ecosystem. And to a degree, I think they're right. But I think parrots have that adaptive mechanism. Like, if they get predated upon by Spiros, their body language adapts. Like, a school of parrots won't behave the same around a Spiro. Like, if I shoot a fish out of a school of parrot today, if I go back tomorrow, that school will respond with their body language by keeping a greater distance from me. I think they have their own protective mechanisms built into them. So I don't think that protecting them by creating no take conditions is necessarily a great idea, because I think the ecosystem's got that built into its own mechanism. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think maybe they were, because they're closer to shore here. Like, I mean, I have them, I can think of two or three small schools, like the docks just across the street from my house. They have them, they'll cruise up and down there, and you'll see them, because we'll hit it for spearfishing, and you'll see them there. And I mean, it's an opportunity of like, somebody can just jump in the water, literally walk in and boom, they're there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It goes back to maybe that culinary history as well. You know, people not wanting to eat them. I don't know if it's a big thing as much here.
Like I said, like historically, I haven't really enjoyed eating them, but I just think it's because of the way I prepared them. So I'll try something different next time I shoot a good one. But they're not generally like a fish I'll deliberately target. That's more opportunistic sort of thing. Like, oh, well, that one looks good. Bang.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you. When you go out, do you target specific species, or do you generally, are you more of an opportunistic shooter?
I try to target stuff, but it'll be based on what's happening on the day. So, you know, if I've got a big workup on the front edge of a reef because some current's washing over it, and I've got bait, and I've got three schools of Trevally and you know, some other things working through it. Quite often I'll be going for the real iconic, difficult to shoot species, like, you know, I think in Hawaii they call them uku, but the green jobfish, you know, like, they're a really tough species to get onto. Like, you have to be, you know, working hard, like spending bottom time, or you can sort of do the burley or the chum trick, but I prefer generally not to. And when you've got current, even getting chum or burley right and getting the jobfish up the water column can be quite difficult. So, yeah, but other days, you know, like, it might be quite quiet, but you will see the odd parrot around, and they're quite vulnerable to a top-down shot because of the way they sort of, the way their eyes are positioned on their body, it's quite down. So they can't look up very well. So shooting them from top down is quite a, it's a narrow shot to make. You have to be quite accurate, but you seem to be able to get quite close to them from top down, whereas a lot of species, you need to be on a level with them to hunt them. So, yeah, I will shoot them, but it's not generally something I'll target.
Nice. So we talked a little bit about what's in the freezer. What do you got on the menu next? What are you cooking up next, you think?
A recent favorite of mine. Do you guys get salt and vinegar chips or crisps there?
We do, yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I like to take the whole bag and just smash it up and into crumbs, and then I just do flour, egg, and then the salt and vinegar crisp as a crumb, and then just shallow fry and make sure I don't overdo them, and then I'll just use them in tacos or sandwiches or in a salad, however you want. Like, you can just serve it on the plate next to some other, like, you know, dishes and stuff, and goes really well, particularly if you know how to make a homemade tartare, or you buy a real nice how do you say tartare sauce? Is it tartar?
Tartar. Yep.
Tartar sauce. So we call it tartare, but anyway, same. Tomato. I'll do that with that. That's probably like, and it goes real well with a lot of reef species, and even frozen ones. It seems to be. Work a good trick. Like, my motivation for spearfishing goes down when my freezer's full. So I like to have a high turnover of the fish in my freezer.
Yeah. What, do you have a fish that doesn't even make it to the freezer that you're like, I got to eat this right away?
Yeah, yellowtail. We call it yellowtail. Well, it's quite often called a kingy down here, but it can be confusing for you guys because a kingfish where you are is Spanish mackerel down here. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, sometimes we call it a yellowtail kingfish, but I believe it's actually a greater amberjack if you look up the genus and stuff. But anyway, the yellowtail sashimi, fantastic. Like, or, ooh. Yeah, that's a go-to for sure. You just got to chill it back for at least a few hours and make sure you bled it and brained it, or iki jimmy is kind of, I don't think I pronounce it right, but it's a Japanese word for braining a fish. And then
I didn't even know there was a term. Of course there is, but
yeah, we borrowed it from the Japanese, which I think is pretty cool. I think it's Ike Jime or something, but it's like IKIJIME, and I just say Ike Jimmy, which is probably just butchering the hell out of it. But what do you do?
It's such an interesting concept too, because it's like I mean you think about it too, like as hunters, you want the animal to sort of, one, struggle less, two, have low adrenaline, and three, you know, be able to be manageable. And so, like, that optimal shots, like in the spearfishing world, like doing like a stone shot where you're just stoning it and it's immediately just dying, and seeking that same thing in the hunting world is that. But if you don't get that, you always have a way to sort of manage it. And I forget, there was some article, somebody did a little research piece on it, looking at whether or not the fish actually tasted better. Yeah. Even freshwater fish that were line caught, and I think so. It makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. No, yeah, definitely. Brain it as fast as you can and bleed it out. The cleaner the kill, and the cleaner the faster the kill, and bleed it is essential as well. Like, yeah, get all that stuff out of the muscles, and but I also think you got to chill a fish back. Like, I don't think you just pull it up on the deck and start chopping it up straight away for sashimi. No. I think you've got to let that rigor mortis set in, and you've got to chill it back on some ice. And once it's got that chilled tension, it's like it allows some of the weird stuff in the muscles to drain out, and then, makes a lot better eating quality. So, but Yellowtail, if you've chilled it back for a few hours, fantastic. Same as the Spanish mackerel. I think they call it kingfish in your part of the world. Like, I love that sashimi as well. Like, it won't even make it home, or a big slab if it won't.
I haven't had the – I mean, we have the Spanish – we have Spanish mackerel here. Actually, the last recipe I did for Spearing Magazine was Spanish mackerel.
Okay.
Man, it was so good. I love that.
What did you do with it?
So I just did like a little pan sear. I left skin on. Got the skin kind of crispy. Did a pan sear. And then I did like kind of a Sicilian relish. So it was like tomatoes, capers, onions, a couple other like pickled. I think it did black olives in there too. Ooh. And then just put that right on top of it kind of cold and just ate it just like that. Oh my gosh. The vinegar and the pickle and all the stuff in there, the juices just came out so great.
It's a fish that I reckon smokes well too. Just lather in like salt and then brown sugar and just hot smoke it and then leave it in the smoker once you've turned the heat off for another couple of hours, and it just sinks in, and it's some of the best smoked fish I've ever eaten in my life. It's some of the best fish I've eaten full stop in my life.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
So as far as smoked fish, do you eat it just smoked fish and then eat the fillet, or do you mix it in? Because down in the Keys, we do a smoked fish dip. So they'll take the dip and then, or they'll take the fish and then incorporate it into, you know, various types of dips and things like that.
One thing I've become more aware of, I think, you know, as a hunter, you grow, and as a chef and as an appreciator, connoisseur of the things you shoot and hunt, like you get better at it. So I'll be honest, with smoked fish, it comes out of the hot smoker, and if I've got fresh white bread, which is just riddled with gluten, I just
all the gluten.
Smear butter on it, and the smoked fish, if it's still hot, goes straight on there, and I just, yeah, and I can just punish large quantities of Spanish mackerel that way. But I think, like, it's quite versatile, as I'm sort of finding out. You can make a pate, you can make you can make all sorts of stuff with it. You can put it through a salad, you can put it through pasta and, like, do a carbonara with it. There's all different ways you can use it. I'll be honest, if I don't eat it immediately, it goes into a vacuum-packed bag, and I might pull another portion out in a week, and I'll quite happily just open that packet and eat it exactly like that. And I'm a caveman at times.
That's all right. I think we all are. I'll tell everybody, is eloquent as my cooking is sometimes. Like sometimes I was like, I'm hungry, gotta eat now. Like, yep. what's available?
Yeah. But smoked fish, I think the one thing that holds me back with it is my, like, I live in an apartment at the moment, and having a large smoker going on my balcony, while it would be good for me, my neighbors, I don't think, would appreciate it as much. So a lot of the smoked fish I do, I used to do at a buddy Matt's place, and we would do three or four racks and then have a vacuum pack session and just sort of portion it out and give it away. And sometimes, so that was a good afternoon with a couple of drinks and just sit around talking while we waited for the fish to smoke.
I like that. We do. If we get big hauls, we do the same thing. And it's like that whole community and social element to it that I really enjoy.
For sure.
Pretty lucky. I have a good group of guys here. There's like there's about nine of us. I think all in all, we'll rotate out on different boats and stuff.
Yeah, awesome.
They kind of all spear together and fish. So,
do you guys do like a communal, like, fillet or fillet and vacuum pack session, like when you do a bigger trip?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we'll divide everything up like evenly. Like, even if you don't come back, with a fish, like you're getting fish if you were on the boat, which is good because that encourages people to come back out and keep at it. You know, everybody has bad days. Everybody has really good days. Like there's some guys in the group that are really skilled and they, you know, they can get down at depth. And there's some guys like me that are not greatly skilled don't get down at depth. And, some days I shoot good fish, some days I don't.
I like that aspect of it too, man, because like I said, like my motivation for spearfishing goes up and down based on how full my freezer is.
Mm-hmm.
So if I don't give away a quantity of fish, then I don't need to go spearfishing because most of the time I shoot more than enough for my needs, you know. And I'll give some to my neighbour and my close friends and family. And sharing the fish out on the boat, I think it makes sense. Like it's a team, it's more of a team sport these days, I think. Like a lot of it.
I mean, you got somebody driving the boat, you got somebody tending the anchor, you got somebody playing safety on the boat, and then you're partnering up in the water. Like it's very much, I think in order to do it safely, it's definitely a team sport.
Mm-hmm.
So I was scrolling the Noob Spiro Instagram page, and I saw you talking about crayfish.
Yep.
Is it like lobster?
Yeah, same.
Same.
Okay. Tomato. Yeah.
So they do look like, or they come out red like that in the wild. So they look like giant crawfish here, which. Like,
okay. We've got.
I thought was interesting.
We've got like, I think at least 5 species around Australia. And so the ones I think I had in the recent Instagram post were southern rock lobster. So sort of the southern end of Australia. I was actually in South Australia and I was doing a freediving retreat, which was in a limestone sinkhole. And it's famous, and I was doing some freediving certifications there. But of course, while I'm there, I can't just straight freedive. So me and a buddy escaped, and we went down to some local South Australia coastline and went chasing lobster, which I don't know why we call them crayfish. It's a weird thing. They're a lobster. Like every name, official name for them is a lobster. It's a southern rock lobster is the proper name for them. But we spent 2 sessions going out for them. The first time we tried to go wide and deep, and it was really surgy, and we didn't find bugger all, and we didn't actually get any. But the diving was fantastic, and we saw sea lions, and South Australian diving was just amazing. Like cold water, but just beautiful. And then the second time we went out, we tried a different strategy. And I think, like, whether you're spearfishing or hunting, like, you learn from what doesn't work. And, you know, it's that definition of stupidity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So the second time we went out, we realized, like, we tried to go wide and deep, and it was good ground, but it was just surgy and really difficult, like probably 30 feet diving and surge. Like it was quite difficult, and there just wasn't a lot around. So the next time we went out, we were in like 6 feet of water, maybe 10 feet of water, and that's where all the lobster were. And again, we were dealing with surge and really heavy weed. Like you'd have to sort of push kelp out of the way and really ram yourself into it to find the cracks. And then like marking the holes was quite difficult. But once you were in there, then it was just grabbing them and away you went. And we got 3 on our second session. We could have got more, but we only went out for an hour, and we had more than enough to eat for the trip. And we fed like I think 8 people with these lobster. But And I tried. So in New Zealand, where I grew up, a lot of the time when we would cook lobster, we would just boil them, and you boil them, and then just open the meat and the legs, and just eat the meat as is, or you could put it through a salad or do whatever you want. As usual, I just went the simple route and just ate it directly. But and then in Queensland, a lot of the time is they get their crayfish and their lobster, and then they just cut them in half and put them straight on the barbecue. And in South Australia, we tried something different. We parboiled them, which is like, you know, boiling them, but not so that they're completely cooked through. And then we split them, and then we fried them. And it worked really, really well. And I think it's one of the worst things you can do with most seafood, and I think lobster's true of it as well, is if you overcook it, it tastes like shit. And so this time around, parboiled, cut it in half, and then on the barbecue, soaked and lathered in butter and garlic, and it was just excellent. It was just so good.
Sounds good. Chase, do you get a little lobster down here? I don't know what the if you get down to the Keys to do it. during the season?
No, I've never been in Florida, but a couple of years ago I went to the Bahamas and we were able to snag some lobsters over there, and we would just throw them straight on the grill.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. That's what I don't know. I've done a number of things with them, because we have rock lobster here too, but it's all warm water. And I actually, so the majority of like our lobsters are coming from the northeast of the U.S., like Boston, Massachusetts, New England area. And I prefer those lobster. I think they have a more like buttery flavor, and I think they're more tender.
Yep.
Versus the ones that are coming out of Florida and the Caribbean are more tough. And I maybe some relation to water temperature or something, or lifestyle or whatever.
100%. Same thing here. I think the southern, the more temperate water lobster tastes better than the subtropical, tropical water lobster. But yeah, I think, you know, the tropical ones and the subtropical ones really taught me not to overcook them, because I think as soon as you overcook them even a little bit, they're just terrible. So
yeah.
Yeah, but you can apply that same treatment by not overcooking the southern ones, and they taste even better as well. But yeah, there's something about temperate water lobster that's just, oh, so good.
It's delicious. I think that people tend to overcook them too, and I was talking to a buddy last night. We had some elk meat, and we took it to one of the taco shops here, and they do like a cook your catch just for like fish and whatnot. So we're like, oh, hey, maybe they'll cook some of this elk meat for us too. And I knew the cook, and she obliged us. But we were talking about how some people, if they're unfamiliar with the meat or the seafood or whatever, they'll undercook it, because, you know, there's the whole fear of like, oh my gosh, if I undercook it, it's going to, you know, what's going to happen? So I think that falls into play too. And as you experiment and become more comfortable with the foods, it you like fine tune it.
I think there's like there's some urban legends around like seafood gets lumped in with like chicken. And it's like, it's a white meat, so it turns bad really fast, and you've got to cook it to get all the bacteria out of it and stuff like that. But, you know, like the Japanese with sashimi, if nothing else, they've taught us that you can eat the stuff raw, you know. And a lot of cultures have had raw fish recipes, so I'm not saying it was straight Japanese, but a lot of other cultures, like, you know, if you do ceviche, that we're relying on lemon juice to do a lot of the work for us. But, yeah, you can eat the stuff raw. And lobster, people do lobster sashimi. So
I don't think I've ever had it.
I haven't either. I haven't either, but I would like to as well. I'd probably do it with parboiled, though. So it's like semi-cooked. But, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think so. You run into this thing. So here you get a lot of people eating freshwater fish too. And that's definitely, there's parasites present in freshwater fish. That you have to either like freeze out or cook out, and so dropping it super low temps for like multiple days before you do anything with it. We posted it was a ceviche recipe a while back. We have an invasive species here called snakehead. I don't know the specific name, like the more common universal name, but they show up in the Chesapeake Bay of the East Coast, ironically enough, like all the tributaries, and one of our riders would go out and like kind of gig for them with a spotlight at night and with a prong on the end of the pole.
Okay.
So like a pole spear, but slightly different.
Yep.
And then he came back and he prepared a ceviche, and in the initial publication of the recipe, like he had told me, he's like, oh yeah, like I froze this. I know the concerns with parasites because we had a conversation for that. But that line wasn't included in the recipe, and people like lost it. They're like, wait, what are you doing? You're gonna die. Yeah. I was like, whoa. Like, first off, there's no known cases of this particular species like sharing a parasite that can affect humans. I was like, but also in the recipe, like he froze it hard like overnight, and so now we include those little details.
So that caveat is a crucial one sometimes. I do the same thing, because I think some species of ocean fish, you have to do the same. Like I've shot amberjack and yellowtail out here, and it's had parasite in it. And and I think groper species sometimes can possibly have, you know, parasites in them. I'm wary, but, yeah, I think there's some species that I've definitely become more comfortable with doing raw variations of.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to try more raw stuff too. I think so. That's gonna. I'm gonna put that on my list as I move away to Colorado. Speaking of raw, and what's some of the wildest seafood you've eaten, or like you've seen somebody eat?
I lived in China for a year. I taught English there. So honestly, a lot of my most sort of exotic experiences, I guess, were there. I think like Sichuan have this reputation for super spicy food, and Sichuan do a boiled. There's a boiled fish. It's almost like in China they call it huo guo or hot pot, and it's like heavily spiced water. And the fish is always mysterious. You never really know what you're eating. And when you look at their waterways, you just kind of like, you feel like you're taking a gamble with their life. But they've got a West Lake vinegar fish, which is like ginger, sort of heavily ginger flavored and shallow fried. But I mean, back from China, in New Zealand, where I grew up, it was very common for us to be given whitebait fritters. So if you Google whitebait, you'll be like, what the hell? They look like...
I'm really getting it right now.
Almost look like sperm. Like they're transparent. but, you know, like probably maybe 2 inches long and really sort of thin. And almost like, yeah. Yeah, and so we would... You catch them in a net in river mouth when they have their season, their spawning season. And you turn them into a fritter, which, you know, so like egg and... You know, quite often, once you have the fritter, you'd put vinegar on them, and that was a real common one I grew up with in New Zealand. And another one was abalone, or in New Zealand it's called pawa, which is, we'd also turn that into a fritter. So they were some of the more exotic homegrown ones that I grew up with.
Ooh, those are nice. Oh my gosh, the name just slipped me. The first one you mentioned, the
pawa or the abalone.
No.
Oh, the whitebait.
First one.
The whitebait.
Yeah, the whitebait. They look like smelt. We call them like smelt here. It's a similar process. You catch them as they go upstream to spawn. And there's like, it can be the season's like, all right, now they're moving. And then this whatever state turns on the season and people go out there and there's only specific places they can catch them.
Yeah, cool. So
it's pretty cool. So now moving on. So we talked a little bit. You mentioned the podcast earlier. And I was telling you, hitting on sort of the community page on Facebook, and like you built this really awesome community, kind of with the podcast and with your book we're gonna hit on, and social media and all this stuff. And it's just like, what day did you realize, or when did you realize, like, man, look at this, like this is awesome.
I don't know. It's probably a bit like you, Justin. Like, you know, you get a lot of email. And then you sort of think, this conversation would be much better served in front of an entire community, because I feel like this person's tapped onto something that everyone has an opinion and an idea about, you know. And so one thing I really like with the podcast is having a discussion, like long-form conversations and deep dives into specific topics that we're really passionate about. And I think I was listening to another podcast as well, and they started talking about these community groups on Facebook, and I thought, shit, I should do that. And then, so I did it. And then, you know, like, because the disappointing thing about the podcast is that sometimes it's just this conversation that we're having live now, but people want to put in their opinion about it. And why not? So I thought, all right, we'll start a Facebook group, and the thing just went ballistic. And now I don't really promote the podcast on it. Like, it's just very much a group for the community. I mean, it does take a while to grow and get going, but now it's just like... It's like some dude chucked up a post about a pisette, which is like
I was reading through those comments.
You know, like it's a neoprene thing that you sew into your wetsuit, and your dick sits in there, and then you can urinate, so your wetsuit doesn't smell like urine at the end of the day, and your skin's not covered in bacteria. And we, like, if you've been spearfishing a while and you've sat in a car or whatever with, you know, guys that smell like urine, or gear that smells like urine, it's disgusting. And I've done it, and I've been, you know, surrounded by it. So now it's like I'm seriously considering it. And But this guy put this post up about this Bassett, and now, you know, there's 50 comments on it or whatever, and everyone's got an idea about it and wants to learn about it. And I think that's one of the things you can best do with a community group is, like, discuss some of the weird things that go on. And I really like it. It fuels podcasts. Like, I go, all right, well, clearly this needs to be a larger discussion. Let's do it on the podcast. And I don't know that I'm going to do an episode on Bassetts. But, like, nevertheless, it's great that this community has got this culture going. And, I mean, the only things I do to tune it is I say, don't be a dick, you know, like, and by that, I don't want to micromanage the group. So even when people mouth off and they get a little bit silly, I'll just gently pull them up, but I won't delete them or ban them unless they continue to do it. And I don't even think I've had to do it yet. And I don't know, there's more than, I think there's 2,500 people or more in there now. And it's cool. It's super cool to be a part of and to watch unfold and to be partially, to feel like you're partially responsible for it. But I think as a person that moderates the group, your responsibility is to help shape the culture, but then to very much allow it to be its own thing and not just, yeah. So that's kind of my opinion on it.
I think it's so neat to see. I think that's actually how I stumbled. I don't even remember if I saw your podcast first or if I saw the group first, whichever one. But then I reached out to you and was like, hey man, I like what you're doing. Like,
yeah,
love to chat about some food. And fast forward, here we are.
Yeah, man, it was cool to get you on. And I mean, you're definitely the sort of person I like. You know, like, you're a subject matter expert. You know, maybe you haven't spent years and years, like, spearfishing, like, in a hardcore capacity, but you have done that with seafood. And so, it was, yeah, it was cool to, you know, get you on and share some recipes and some insight, because I think that's an aspect of the spearfishing lifestyle that I very much want to get better at. And so if it tickles my itch, then I'm in.
Perfect. I would encourage everybody, go check, not to toot my own horn, but go check out that episode. It was a good one. And yeah, and then scroll through and look at, you know, listen to some of the others. There's, you'll recognize some faces on there. Justin Lee used to write for was a field staff writer with us for a while, back a while ago. He's been on the podcast too.
He's a super cool dude. Yeah, Kimmy Werner's another Hawaiian on there. She's awesome too, and very much like a foodie. And and an interesting person, but yeah.
I've tuned into her YouTube channel, and I really enjoy it. She goes on some cool stuff. They were up in Alaska for a while, and I was like, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, the community stuff is cool too. Like, I've started, like, doing live interviews. Like, so I'll go into a spearfishing store, like one of the sponsors for the show, and I'll run like a live interview and get 40 or 50 people in there and share pizza and have a few beers after. And I think the online culture, if you have strong values, like, and you put forth an idea of what the culture you want to sort of create, I think those people, some people it puts them off and they never come, but they're not my people anyway and I don't like them. So good. And I would rather not have them. But what it does is it creates a cool place for the people that do share those same values to hang out and stuff. And that was another thing I got, is like, just like, I don't know, you can't be vanilla, you know, you've got to have some opinions and stand on some ground. And like, sometimes it does you favors and sometimes other people don't like you for it, but regardless, at least it's something you want to be part of.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if it's one of those things too, you know, like you said, if it seems cool to me or it seems interesting to me, then other people are probably interested in it as well. Or if I feel comfortable in this community or I feel comfortable engaging in this way, like, other people are probably going to do too. Like, there's some very apparent in our cultures, there's very apparent, like, red lines, like, nope, don't do that. Like, don't behave this manner. Don't say that, you know?
Well, I did an episode a little while ago and it was very much community generated. It was about death piles, which is, in Florida, they call it the dock of death photos. And it seems to be a phase of a Spiro sort of maturity journey where they post these photos and they get some mad social props for it or something. But regardless of whether it's right or wrong, I wanted to have the conversation in a real free-form way and allow everyone to express their views on this particular phenomenon on social media. And jeepers, I've got a lot of interaction around it, a lot of robust conversation, but it was cool. And some people thought I didn't take a hard stance on it, and I didn't. I don't think that's my role. And my role was to facilitate the conversation rather than, you know, just like stand on a soapbox and preach at people. So, yeah.
I'm in agreement with you, and I think that that's where I don't know. I don't know if I've made this super clear to a lot of our listeners or people that read or follow or do whatever. Like, I don't pretend to be the expert at anything, and I don't want people looking at me being like, oh yeah, that guy's, you know, the defining point for our culture. Like, no, culture is very much involved in everybody. Yep. And I want that to remain that way. And that's the way that I like Harvesting Nature to be. Like, we're going to tell stories. We're going to share food. You know, we want to bring people to our community. We don't want to set the guidelines or the absolutes for our community. And I think that's such an important thing for me.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard, man. I had a guy.
Oh yeah.
Actually, I had a Floridian woman, Lorena Sarasua, I think is her name.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
she's got a YouTube channel and she's just rad. She seems like a pretty good freediver, and she's a great spiro. And she posted a video up, and this guy got on, and he was really, really heavy-handed with the way he criticized her. And I don't actually mind criticism. I think criticism's a healthy part of having a great culture, and you should be able to do it, and by all means do it. But he got really disrespectful and like over the top with it. And it was kind of making me ask some questions like, hey, is this guy gone too far and should I get rid of him?
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, no, he's made a dick of himself, and I'll reinforce that by putting a comment on there, and then I'll just leave it for the world to see. If you want to behave like that, by all means do so. But a lot of people are just going to think you're a dick, and you don't need to cancel them. You just allow them to say what they want. And I don't know. I hope she's all right, because some of his stuff I thought was way over the top. But anyway,
I saw her responses. It seems like she was responding pretty like seriously, like whatever, man.
Yeah,
type deal. But yeah, no, she's super cool. She was on the podcast as well.
Oh, cool.
She's just up the road, just north of Miami, I believe.
I listened to that interview. Yeah, that was a good chat.
When lobsters bite back.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Anybody that was bit by a lobster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, oh, I will mention, so all the different episodes that we talk about on your podcast and our podcast here, we'll throw those in the show notes. Everybody has a quick link. We always do that, but I like to remind everybody to go scroll through the show notes. There's lots of interesting tidbits there.
Cool.
Plus, Corey puts a lot of work into putting those together. I want to make sure people are recognizing the hard work. So, the time's ticking, but I do want to chat a little bit about your book, 99 Tips to Get Better at Spearfishing, because it's going to, I think, cover two points that I kind of want to explore for the listeners as far as people who are already spearfishing, like ways to tune up and get better, and then people who are interested in spearfishing and maybe haven't, pun intended, pulled the trigger.
Boom, I like it.
So as far as like tying the book with the podcast and the website and your vault blog, like where did that come into play at?
At the time, I think Turbo and I were co-hosting the show full on together, and I invited him into the Noob Spiro right at the start, and he co-hosted, and it was all just banter and silliness really. And we'd both been spearing for about somewhere between 2 and 4 years each. And so the first 40 interviews, we sort of turned around and we went, hey, we need to produce a book. Like, we should be teaching people more about how to start spearfishing, you know, because sometimes a podcast is more ad hoc, you know, like, and it's not really a comprehensive sort of thing. So we sort of said, well, let's write a comprehensive guide to start spearfishing. And then I thought, well, we started doing that, and that's a huge exercise. We thought, why not just distill some of the best tips and advice that have been given to us in the first 40 interviews, along with our own experiences that have shaped us, and put that into a quick start guide. And so that's what we did. And then it saw numerous revisions. And but yeah, it was a really cool part and project to be involved with. We crowdfunded that on Kickstarter and raised a bit of money, which paid for like a big printing run, and it was cool. It's the book still sells now like pretty well on Amazon, and I'm super stoked with it and proud of it.
It is. It's awesome. I get a. I'm actually gonna. I'm gonna order a copy.
Wow.
Sorry, I haven't bought one yet.
I should probably just send you 3 copies to give away to listeners. How about that?
Oh, that'd be good. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do that for you.
We'll talk after the show and figure out what creative way we want to give them out.
Cool. I'll send you 4 and you can have one. How's that?
Oh, sweet. That'd be awesome. Cool. So what would be, looking into it, and I don't want you to dive too deep into it because I want people to go check it out on their own, but like what would be like a hot tip for someone who's like getting into spearfishing?
Let me just talk broadly. So spearfishing is like everyone thinks like, oh, cool, I'm going to learn this magic breath hold technique. Boom, I'm going to get down, I'm going to hold my breath, and I'm going to shoot a fish. Nah, that's not going to happen. Like it's a journey of 1,000 steps. And like I think the 99 tips to get better at spearfishing, it's like if you can like, even if you're experienced, right, and you learn one thing that improves your spearfishing 1%, you realize how huge that is. So the value of like reading 99 tips is if one of those tips makes a huge difference in your spearfishing, as far as we were concerned, it's a good investment for you. And so we were kind of trying to cater towards all ends of the spectrum. Obviously, the less you know, probably the more value you're going to get out of it. I think some of the best tips in the book for someone starting out is don't buy your gear online, particularly when you're starting. Go and find a specialist retailer and build a relationship with them. And you'll know very quickly whether they're good people or not. And don't rely on some jaded 10-year veteran with their solo opinion that the store is shit. Get a spread of information from 4 or 5 locals, and then you'll have a better idea. Because sometimes, like if you're experienced and you have a bad interaction with one salesperson in a store, all of a sudden to you, you just wipe them. So don't do that. Like find a local retailer, build a relationship with them. If they're good people, stay there, and they'll give you advice about everything from dive buddies to what equipment is best in your local water. And they'll even put you on the dive spots. They'll put you on dive trips, and they'll put you into which is the best spearfishing club to join. As far as I'm concerned, that's a huge way to plug in. I guess if I gave another second tip, because I've got a big mouth and I like talking, I would say a freediving course or a specialist spearfishing course is going to be money well spent. Like in a condensed period of time, you're going to learn things that take people years and years of reading and learning on their own and watching YouTube videos. There's something about in-person training where you get direct feedback and you get to work on skills in a real sort of dedicated capacity. I'm a big fan of live stuff. As good as podcasts are, and obviously I want people to listen to my podcast, but you know, if you can do a proper freediving course with a person that's familiar with spearfishing, that thing's, particularly in your early days, is going to just add miles and miles to your experience and knowledge. I wanted a chance to promote an upcoming project that I've invited you to be part of too. And, you know, I thought we've got 99 tips to get better at spearfishing. The next project coming off the rank is 99 Spearo Recipes, which is actionable meals for the everyday diver. And I wanted, you know, Harvesting Nature to be very much a part of it and submit a few recipes. And we'll get some books out for your community as well. But I want people to expand beyond that 2-3 go-to recipes and really sort of broaden their ideas about what's capable with the fish and the resource that they, you know, they take. And so that look out for that book. It won't be out probably this year, but I'll get it done. It'll be out early next year.
I'm excited to hop onto that and be part of it. I know you and I've had some discussions about it, so but I'm really looking forward to that project. And Chase, I think, would be a great fit for it too, being part of the Spearo community and the wild fish cooking and game cooking. It's got some added value.
Yeah, man, I've got a whole lot of recipes running through my head. They're my usual go tos.
What do you think of the concept? What would you add or change to it?
To the concept of the book?
Yeah.
No, I think it's brilliant. Especially if you could just tailor it to the spearfishing community, because why not?
Yeah. Well, I thought, like, you know, we were talking about community before, Justin and I, and we were talking about how much power there is, and like everyone's really, really good at, you know, maybe a couple of things. You know, why not harness that, I reckon? Because none of us, I don't have 100 spearfishing recipes off the top of my head. I've probably got 10 or 15. And I've been doing it for more than 10 years. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's solid. I think as long as you're speaking, because then you look at like the geographical side of it too. Like looking all across the world is like having recipes that can translate different types of seafood. Mm. I think it will be a good one too.
I'll have to write everything like in like ounces for you guys.
Yeah. Your pronunciation of the American version of tartar sauce kills me.
I can do more if you want, but great. Yeah.
Oh man. All right. Well, I definitely say we're solidly, the clock is ticking. So,
yeah. Oh, good man.
No, I think it's good. I'm excited about that, the new book project. But how can people connect with you best? We talked about community, but outside of that, what are some other good ways? Yeah.
Some people are like, what's your thing called? It's Noob Spiro. So very much about like the name, even the name is about pulling the ego out of it. Like no one cares how long you can hold your breath. No one cares how big the fish you are that shit. You know, like just be a good person, you know, don't be a dick. And that's kind of the values of the show. Like I've never been the best Spiro in the world. I don't think I'll ever will be. And for me, it's not really about that. It's about the lifestyle. So Noob is N-O-O-B, which comes from online gaming. You know, like no one wants to be a noob, but we all are at some point. And Spiro, which is, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, and you love the spearfishing lifestyle, you're a Spiro. So S-P-E-A-R-O. And you can find Noob Spiro on anywhere, man. Instagram. I think we've got a TikTok. I don't know how it works, but and then the Noob Spiro community on Facebook, noobspiro.com, any of that stuff, man. Thanks for having me on. It's an honor, man, and really cool to connect with like-minded people.
Yeah, absolutely. Jace, do you have a last thought? Anything for us?
Hey, man, thanks for being on. Thanks for inviting me, Justin. Yeah. Can't wait to see what the next project is. And I'm picturing like a coffee table book with really nice spearfishing photos.
100%.
Raw from all over the world.
Yes. You're in, Chase. You're in.
Awesome. Well, I echo that. Thanks for coming on, man. It was awesome. You hosted me and we had such a great time chatting there that I was like, you know what? I want to have him on our show, and so I was hounding the guys to create some time, and we did, and yep. our schedules on the other side of the world finally lined up, which worked out great. So
and I got to tell you, I got to tell you all about tartar.
Tartar. Awesome. Well, everyone out there, thanks for listening. As always, show notes, as I mentioned earlier, are always available online. Head over to social media. Make sure you're following the Noob Spiro, and make sure you're also following Harvesting Nature, which you should be if you're listening to the show. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, hit that 5-star button. Tell us what we're doing right or tell us what we're doing wrong. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
Four in the morning.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Birds up in the sky.